It's Tom Bilyeu here. And if you are addicted to the relentless pursuit of greatness, then I've got something special for you guys. The Motivation Daily Podcast by Motiversity. It's your daily fix of motivation, inspiration, and wisdom featuring the best speeches and speakers on the planet. We cover it all. Life, business, relationships, discipline, purpose, mental health, sports, studying, focus, you name it. With exclusive speeches from heavy hitters like Coach Payne, Billy Allsbrooks, Marcus Taylor, Dr. Jessica Houston, Walter Bond, and more. If you're ready to take control, level up, or just crush your day, then Motivation Daily Podcast is your secret weapon. Search for the Motivation Daily Podcast and follow wherever you listen to amazing podcasts. What's up, guys? You're about to hear part one of my two-part interview with Raoul Paul. I've had him on the show before, but this time, this is the most important interview that I've done with him to date. There are few people that understand where the world is going better than Raoul, and in this episode, we walk through what he calls the Everything Code. It's literally a prediction engine that provides a framework with which you can evaluate the most likely paths the future economy is going to take. In part one of this episode, we jump right into the deep end with Raoul's thesis of what he calls the glide path to a potential soft landing, but we also discuss whether or not that's actually the most likely scenario, or are we headed towards a nosedive that may take the U.S. economy with it. Not going to want to miss this episode. And on a side note, we've just launched our exclusive Impact Theory subscription that takes your podcast listening experience to the next level. You can now listen to Impact Theory completely ad-free, and we've also curated amazing playlists on topics like health, mindset, business, and relationships, making it easy for you to dive deep with hundreds of different experts on incredible topics. You can subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or on Supercast for other platforms. Get started, guys, today. I'm Tom Bilyeu, and welcome to Impact Theory. We have a financial system that is a volcano waiting to erupt, and it is inevitable that it will erupt and will obliterate life as we know it, and it is only a question of when. And so I don't know if it happens in 5 years, 50 years, 100 years. Can't imagine it's more than 50, but I think it's going to be cataclysmic. Am I barking up the right tree?
No.
All right, here we go. Tell me about it. So where do you think we are right now?
The world blew up in 2008. The world is now entirely about the management of the debts. That is everything now. And there are two ways for that to happen. If we didn't do quantitative easing in 2008, 9, 10, 11, you know, all of that stuff, the world would have burnt and destroyed in the manner that you thought. Which is like the Argentina collapse, you know, the Cyprus collapse, this huge destruction. What we chose was a glide path.
Glide to where? Because my thinking is you glide until you crash. It's a slower crash for sure.
Well, the crash is ongoing, but you're buying time for GDP growth to come back, right? Our problem is if you're in debt and you don't have enough income, i.e. your income's not growing enough to service your debts, you get into a problem. So what we've been doing is monetizing those interest payments on the debt, which is basically using your credit card to pay off your credit card or to, using your credit card to pay off your mortgage. Okay, that's not sustainable. But what you're hoping is that eventually your income goes up. And there are ways to do that. And the big issue here is demographics.
Let me ask you a very pointed question before we move on. When was the last time real wages went up?
They haven't really risen since about 1972, 1974.
And this is why I think the glide path is going to be gnarly. So I don't want to skip ahead too much because we are definitely not ready for this part of the conversation, but I'm very curious. Is it increased productivity born of the exponential technologies that are happening? Is that what you think is the
thing? That is the only option we have.
Okay. And right that now, I want people to hear dun, 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 like playing in the background because I think that that will, that is going to create the world's gnarliest 20-year period. And so agreed, we get on the other side of this. I'm super optimistic 20 years from now. I am just real worried about the next 20 years. Okay, so planting that terrifying seed for people. Now, if you don't mind,
walk us through. So we know what your punchline is. We're gliding and it's buying us enough time that we can get to a new lily pad. That lily pad is exponential technology that increases productivity and addresses real wage increase for the first time since 1972. But I want people to hear that. 1972 was a long time ago. So we haven't been able to do it yet, even with the internet.
Yeah, that was the death of the American dream that happened. Is the American dream was you participate in the US economy, you get richer. The reality is it didn't happen. And I'll come back to why. Because this is a really important story, because everybody has a thesis on who's to blame, what's to blame, how it happened. Who's to blame is probably, as an Englishman, the French. It's actually all about the Treaty of Versailles. It's actually the Germans who are to blame for all of this. So after World War I, everybody was so pissed what happened with Germany and the war that the US, the UK, and the French got together and said, we want Germany to pay war repatriations, i.e. that would make good for the devastation of Europe. Germany couldn't pay it. So they eventually hyperinflated their economy and the rise of populism, which was
okay.
Hitler's Germany.
Hyperinflation is going to be so important in this discussion.
Yeah.
I think it's worth taking a second to explain why hyperinflation is a go-to strategy, one that we're using right now, by my estimation. What is hyperinflation? How does it happen? Why is it a go-to strategy?
Hyperinflation is when you issue more money to pay your debts, and it comes in an endless cycle because you're not generating GDP growth. So you just keep printing money. So an excess of anything, in extremis, everything becomes worthless. So if you're thirsty and you've come out of the desert and somebody gives you a bottle of water, you'll pay pretty much anything for it. If somebody's there with a million bottles of water, what's a bottle worth to you? Almost nothing. Once you've had the first one, right? So anything in excess supply, just supply and demand, too much supply of currency, the value goes down. So what happened in Germany is they had these gigantic, impossible to pay debts to the West. So they printed as much money as possible. That blew up spectacularly. Prices rose millions of percent.
And really fast, I want to use a different word for people, and a shout out to Robert Breedlove for introducing this idea to me. If you change one word from print to counterfeit, people understand what's actually happening. And so if you think of printing money as government-approved counterfeiting, then it's like, oh, because I think people have an intuitive understanding for why counterfeiting is bad, but I certainly didn't have an intuitive understanding for why government printing is bad, which, shame on me. But once I realized, oh, yes, this is literally the equivalent of a guy at home with a printing press just making more money.
That's right. But so let's carry on with the story. So the Germans destroyed their economy. The people got angry.
Because the only way to pay their debt was to make up fake money. Fake. It's not really fake. But they make it up so they can pay it.
And every time you got paid as a German citizen, that fistful of notes barely bought you a loaf of bread one day and half a loaf of bread the next day, and then nothing at all until you have wheelbarrows full of cash. And we've seen this in Argentina. We've seen it in Venezuela. We've seen it in plenty of countries. We just saw it in Lebanon recently as well. That's a total collapse of the value of a currency. Okay, so therefore, all of your productivity as a human is devalued as well because you can't buy anything. So you end up having to ignore currency and barter. And we've seen that in many places as well, because the value exchange of a currency in the middle, because it falls so fast in value, it's a nightmare to deal with. And it's a destruction of total destruction of wealth, except those who own assets. And that's an important point we'll come to much later. So Germany goes to war again. End of World War II. Everybody's like, okay, we're done with this now.
Out of curiosity, how well do you know the story of Hitler's rise? How does he restabilize the economy?
He starts building roads. He starts rebuilding Germany and making them proud in Germany, nationalism.
But how does he pay them? Like, if their money's worthless, how does he get
them? I think they'd already reset the currency after that. So he didn't rise out of the currency collapse. He rose post the currency collapse. So
got it.
You've now got the new currency. I can't remember if it was the Reichsmark, whichever one it was at the time. So, or the Deutschmark. So anyway, so Hitler comes. So World War II, peace in our time. And humans celebrate in the way the humans do. They all had sex and had babies because they felt like there was security. And what we got, and this is the most important point of the story, what we got was the largest population bulge the world has ever seen. They're called the baby boomers. The baby boomers were all doing the same thing at the same time because there's a massive group of them. 76 million of them were born in the United States alone, but we had it across Europe. We had it everywhere. That cohort was what caused the 1970s inflation because they're a bunch of 20 to 30-year-olds go into the workforce at the same time. And this is the important point. I'll come on to this workforce point. They come into the workforce at the same time and they all buy their first house, their first car, their first suit, their first tie, their first everything. They all get married. They all have kids all at the same time. Right. So that's a competition for resources that was unparalleled. The rate of change of demand increase was massive. And that was the 70s inflation. I don't think it's a monetary phenomena. I think it's a demographic phenomena. And I spent a long time talking about that. Demand driven, which is why it's so impossible to deal with. While right now it's not demand driven inflation, it was supply issues. Okay. But those baby boomers, remember, went into the workforce at the same time. So I'm an employer. I have a factory in America. And suddenly I've got 76 million people I can choose from to give a job to. Of course, I'm not going to pay them more money. Why should I? I don't have to because they're all looking for a job. So there's too many people. Remember, excess supply means falling in prices. Excess supply of people, wages don't go up. So this is a function of demographics. It's not a function of the man. It's not a function of somebody doing something bad. It's the problem of people shagging in celebration for the end of World War II. That is now, the actual issue.
Quick question. Is that moment of the flood of the boomers coming in, is that a good moment for the greatest generation, their parents, who are basically now the owners of the factories by the time that they come into the workforce? And it's like, hey, I don't have to pay more money. And P.S., the price at which I can sell the things that I'm making is going up because there's so many people buying it. That moment feels like it would be good for someone.
Yes, because labor cost is low versus a booming economy, which is what we had. So we had labor costs not going up, so margins for corporation goes up, but we had inflation that ate into it. But then the 80s onwards, it's been a one-way street. So that competition for wages actually gets worse because by the mid-80s, the computer's now in the workforce, you know, and it's everywhere. The PC, the mainframe, everything. So now you've got something that can do jobs. So what happens is wages don't go up. And then 1996, we have the World Trade Organization agreement and NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. So now you're bringing in other workers who are paid less to compete against US workers.
There was a guy that warned against this, right? Like
James Goldsmith, the trap.
Yeah, walk me through that. This was very interesting.
So I in 1996 was a free trade person. I was like, of course, everybody should trade free. And I think they should. But he said, you have to do it on the right terms because you'll totally destroy society because everybody will undertake labor arbitrage. And that means all of the capital and the labor all accrues to China, Vietnam and other places. So these Chinese workers were the cost input for goods in the West. So goods fell in value. We had kind of deflation, disinflation, etc. But what happened was US workers didn't have jobs and you could never raise their wages because if you try and raise your wage, you're just going to offshore and get it from India or China or somewhere else. But James Goldsmith's point was yes, it will benefit the Chinese economy, but the Chinese worker probably won't benefit to the same order of magnitude because a lot of these economies are kleptocracies. So somebody's going to take the money. So there'll be a bunch of super rich who'll make all of the money in those countries. And the business owners in the West will make all of the money and the worker will get destroyed. And he said, this is going to lead to populism anger, and this is not the right answer. His idea was the right answer. And there's a Charlie Rose interview I urge everybody to watch. Charlie Rose, James Goldsmith. The guy's terrifyingly intense and terrifyingly smart. Incredible interview. So his idea was, don't allow labor to be the arbitrage. Allow a US company to go manufacture goods in China for Chinese market, but don't export those goods, because that's going to create this problem. And he was absolutely right. Everybody thought he was an idiot. And he's a true capitalist. James Goldsmith's a ultimate capitalist. And everyone's like, well, this guy is being, you know, some sort of trade protectionist. He's crazy. But he was right. But then, so the WTO, and then China eventually enters in 2000. So we've got no chance for wages to go up. And now we've just added the next leg of the equation, which is AI and robotics. The wages are never going to go up. They're never going to stay up. So what has happened is that
really
has meant
on that. So as a CEO, that doesn't feel true to me, but to channel your boy, William Goldsmith,
James Goldsmith,
thank you. What it feels like is happening right now is that you have so many workers refusing to work that even though there are a lot of people that are of that age that theoretically you would expect to be flooding the market, you have so many people going out and we're printing so much money that they can afford to do that. You've got so many government subsidies, whatever, that now people willing to work become a scarce resource, even though there are technically a lot of workers. So I am paying more for sure now than I was even 2 or 3 years ago. Now, what that comes out at a population level, I don't know, but I saw somebody ask this poll on Twitter I think it was actually at an event that my wife was speaking at. Anyway, they asked, like, who here has had to pay more for high caliber talent in the last couple of years? And massive number of people raised their hand. And I was like, oh my God, yes. Like, I didn't even think about it sort of beyond myself. I wasn't thinking about it as a trend, but that really feels true. Does that ring true to you? Or once you even it across the population, you're like, no.
Firstly, you're confusing real and nominal. Real wages have not gone up versus prices.
Okay. Meaning
so
I'm
prices
just, it's
rose
not
more
out
than wages. So if you look at peak, I don't know what peak wages were, but let's say they were 6% last year, you know, year on year wage growth, but peak prices were 9%. So people actually got poorer, which is why we've got a recession going on, because everybody lost purchasing power versus just basic goods.
So would you say we are in a recession already?
Yes. Yeah, by every indicator I've got, we're in a recession, and it will become more abundantly clear. The other thing I think is a point that's also important is we need to think about total aggregate demand within an economy and who are you giving those increased wages to, right? So yes, you are paying more for scarce labor, certain skill sets, expertise, whatever. But when the labor force participation rate is only 65%, you have to average that over 65% of the economy, not 100%. And that's the function of demographics. So there's a whole bunch of people who are retired who wages can't go up, which is retirees, which is basically that 35% is that bucket plus people who've opted out. So you actually reduce it by that. And the labor force participation rate is actually a function of the birth deaths rate forward lagged 30 years. So what we know is we know in the future that there's going to be less and less people in the workforce, which is interesting. And it actually mirrors inflation, GDP growth, everything's driven by this monumental demographic issue. So yes, you're paying up for wages, but your margins have gone down anyway because the other costs of input. So real wages for everybody have actually gone negative, massively negative, which is why everybody's feeling the pinch. That's the issue we've got, and that demographics does not go away. We know that, because we can look at the birth deaths rate today and we can figure out what the population is going to be like in 50 years' time, 70 years' time, 20 years' time, all of this. The only difference of changing that is immigration. So why this is important is it's something I call the magic formula. Magic formula is economic growth. Economic growth is driven by three factors and three factors only at long-term level in an aside from just the normal business cycle ups and downs. Population growth. The more population you have, the more your economy has activity. So population growth. Well, population shrinking the entire Western world. The only way of offsetting that is immigration. But we talked about the fact that the workers are angry. They can't get wage rises. There is a less of a desire to have immigration than there was maybe 20 years ago. So most countries have started to restrict immigration. Fine. So there's no way of solving the population side. The next part of the magic formula is productivity. That's how much output each of us can generate for the economy, and that becomes more efficient. Problem is, it seems to be a function of demographics too. And productivity has been declining since the 70s. Well, actually since the 50s. So productivity is going down. The population is shrinking over time. So the answer was debt. The answer all the way through this equation from these people who were sold the American dream back in the 1950s, the baby boomers. You know, they're listening to Elvis Presley, getting into the Beatles. They're like, let's go, the American dream, I'm going to get rich. But as we pointed out, their wages never went up. But because there were so many of these people, they competed for houses and houses went up. They invested in the stock market went up. Everything, all assets got more expensive because of their demand. So they did the rational thing, which is I'm just going to borrow money. And the difference between the rise of the assets and their wages is essentially what the debt was. The debt side of the equation is what the government's done too, because GDP is declining. The trend rate of GDP keeps going down.
One question that I don't quite understand is, why is debt taken into account when we factor GDP? Is it because we're essentially bringing new money online when we make those loans?
Essentially, yes. You're leveraging your ability to consume stuff or invest in stuff. Now, at an economic level, you might argue, well, you know, you're taking it from one person for another, but there's interest payments. There's a whole bunch of mechanisms. But really, if you see the Chinese economy, and what happened is they did the same. They had population coming in, productivity probably rising, but then they massively borrowed money. So they had the fastest growing economy in the world for a long period of time. You know, leverage gives the illusion of growth, but obviously it has a payback later. And this is the payback we've got now. The leverage that the baby boomers took on, their governments took on, and the corporations took on for all of this issue is what we're dealing with now. So wages didn't go up, assets went up because they were competing for them. Like, you're competing for scarce resources of people right now. But when you put 76 million people in, the housing market goes up. The stock market goes up because they start pension plans and stuff like that. So the difference is debt. And that was okay. Although we were all starting to look at this saying, whoa, this is now getting absurdly debt laden. The government's 100% of debt. The private sector's 100% of debt. Households are 100% of GDP in debt. It's like, whoa, this is out of control. Then 2008 comes along. And that is the debt crisis. I mean, every fucking bank blew up. I mean, everything blew up. It was a complete, total collapse. And that rolled on into Europe in 2012 when the governments, Spain, Italy, et cetera, blew up. And all the banks in Europe blew up.
I think this is where you and I begin to diverge. So when I look at 2008, it feels like we just kicked the can. And the thing that I'm worried about is that you can only kick the can for so long. And at some point, you're going to run out of ability to glide and you do hit the ground.
Well, let's go through this because this is an important point. My view is 2008 was the uncovering that the geyser is not a geyser, it's a volcano. They see it and it's like the holy shit moment. So they did something unparalleled. The Great Reset happened. They reset all interest rates to zero. I had not realized this until recently. That was the debt jubilee. We will reset all payments to zero because we understand. And then Europe kind of forced the car, 2012. It was then, okay, there's no way around this. So the blow up happens. But it's now disguised. And the disguise is the important next part of the story. Because what they did is somewhere around 2012, I believe, G7 made the agreement, learnt from the Japanese, which is...
G7 are the seven biggest
nations in the world. seven nations in the world.
Okay. Nothing to do with their central banks at this point.
No, but it's the finance ministers who get together. But there's a realization, and I think the Japanese realized it first. When your government debt is 100% of GDP, this is the really important point of the Everything Code. When your government debt is 100% of GDP and your private sector debt is, for easy maths, call it 100% of GDP in debt. Okay. Now, interest rates, let's say they're 2% for easy numbers. So when the government has to pay, well, economic growth is what pays for debt, right? It's the earnings of the economy. So if economic growth is growing at 2% and interest rates are at 2%, then the government, which is 100% of GDP in debt, uses all economic growth to pay the interest. Mm. So then the private sector has got to pay its 2%. And that means the economy would contract and this would continue in perpetuity.
When it comes to personal health, I am a huge proponent of using any technology that you can get your hands on to inform and empower you to make better decisions so you can reach your peak performance. And that's why I am pumped to introduce you to Lumen. An amazing new tool that can help you increase your energy levels, feel better, lose weight, maintain healthy weight, and much more. Lumen is the world's first handheld device that measures your metabolism through your breath. And after analyzing your breath, the app is going to give you tailored guidance and tips to help you overall improve your metabolic flexibility. Lumen is validated by peer-reviewed scientific research, and their recommendations are personalized to your measurements so you know you're doing what's best for your individual body. When you use Lumen, it's easier than ever to stay on top of your health game. So if you want to take the next step in improving your health, go to go.lumen.me/impact or just click the link below and you'll get $50 off your Lumen.
The competition business owners face today is massive compared to even just 20 years ago when I first got into entrepreneurship. So if you want a fighting chance against the competition, you need to be using the best technology and platforms in the world like Shopify. For whatever and wherever you want to sell, from launching to going international, Shopify is the global commerce platform that will help you grow at every stage of your business. With award-winning customer service, the internet's highest converting checkout page, and a suite of integrated AI tools, Shopify is your all-in-one platform to quickly and efficiently take your business to the next level. Shopify powers more than 10% of all U.S. e-commerce because businesses that want to grow quickly and efficiently choose Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/impact, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/impact now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/impact.
It's Tom Bilyeu here. And if you are addicted to the relentless pursuit of greatness, then I've got something special for you guys. The Motivation Daily Podcast by Motiversity. It's your daily fix of motivation, inspiration, and wisdom featuring the best speeches and speakers on the planet. We cover it all. Life, business, relationships, discipline, purpose, mental health, sports, studying, focus, you name it. With exclusive speeches from heavy hitters like Coach Payne, Billy Allsbrooks, Marcus Taylor, Dr. Jessica Houston, Walter Bond, and more. If you're ready to take control, level up, or just crush your day, then Motivation Daily Podcast is your secret weapon. Search for the Motivation Daily Podcast and follow wherever you listen to amazing podcasts.
So they look at this
before, before we move on to the Everything Code, because I want to go through that in detail. I want to recap how we've got here and what here is. So here is effectively, we have this constant looping cycle of debt where we have these boom and bust periods because we are masking that a blow up happened in 2008, which was this devastating moment where we realized, okay, the whole system is very fragile because people are disguising the fact that real wages are not going up by taking on more and more debt, both at the individual level and at the governmental level. We've also weakened because of the demographic boom. We have, we go into this globalization moment where we are driving the cost of goods down by doing labor arbitrage and very well predicted that what's going to end up happening is you will begin creating a schism where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, because the quote unquote poor or middle, what used to be the middle class, they are the workers. They're building your cars, your widgets, your whatever. But if you use the labor arbitrage and you send that to a foreign country where labor is cheaper, yay, the people that own assets are very excited, because the companies that are overseas, that the asset is they own a piece of that company, just to be very clear. And so the people that own the assets in these companies that are using labor arbitrage to drive the cost of their goods down, to drive their revenues up, they're loving life. But all the people that used to go to the factory, they're either stagnant, down, or headed towards, you know, the deaths of despair route, where people are just doing drugs. If anybody wants to understand the opioid epidemic in the US, that's
going
to be a big part of it. Yep. I mean, this is why this is necessary before we can talk about the everything code. So, okay. So that we're in that world where everybody is disguising the problem through debt, but eventually you're going to hit a come to Jesus moment where you just can't keep going up. We had a massive bubble in the housing market that pops, boom, like a series of things, series of dominoes fall. Now, the reason that I say this is where you and I begin to diverge in terms of where we're predicting what goes on in the future is a stat that you'll know better than I, but the number of banks that it took to wipe out, I forget how many billions of dollars in value, was like 500 or something during the 2008 collapse. What we've just gone through with the collapse of four banks, we had even more value wiped out. So we have this consolidation of all these, what used to be, you know, back in the 1920s, when 1929 happened, it was like 5,000 banks or more had to collapse before we wiped out as much value as we've wiped out recently in the banking crisis, with, again, four banks wiping out not quite as much value as were wiped out in the Great Depression, but it's distressingly close. So 5,000 banks, now it only takes four banks to wipe out the same amount of value. And so it's like, I just feel the system is getting more fragile. It's not like we're just going horizontal. We're getting more fragile with every passing day, every time this boom and bust cycle happens. And again, we're papering over this simply by making money out of nowhere. And I really want people to understand that we are making money out of nowhere.
So we'll come onto the outcomes in a bit. What we are doing since 2008 is mutualizing the bankruptcy of the system via the debasement of currency, which is the...
When you say mutualizing, you mean making it everybody's problem?
Yes. You can either raise taxes, which they're trying to do too, but they're also printing currency via the mechanism called quantitative easing, which is actually debasing the currency, which means that every time they do it, asset prices optically rise. They don't actually rise, because if you look at the central bank balance sheet and divide all assets by it, so you're changing the denominator, it's normally US dollars, but when you use the balance sheet, you say, okay, this is the purchasing power of dollars, and how many dollars are in the economy or excess printed. And what you find is something like the S&P 500 has gone nowhere. Real estate, gold, gone nowhere. And there's only two assets that have actually outperformed, which were crypto and technology. Okay, which is why we all feel like even though stocks are going up and our 401k is going up, nobody's getting any richer. Okay, we all know this intuitively, that we're not actually getting richer, because the stocks I sell doesn't buy me more of a house. So what the fuck? What was the point of buying the stocks? The value of my assets aren't going up. But that is a mutualization, which is bad because it mutualizes it amongst people who don't have assets. So you'll never be able to buy an asset, which is why when you speak to a millennial now, they're like, we can't afford a house. Why? Because they came in to the labor force after the Fed started monetizing or lowering the value of the denominator. So property's got more and more expensive for them. It's impossible for them to buy property, really, unless they're really lucky in the workforce or in entrepreneurship or whatever it is. But generally speaking, it's become impossible. And everything has got more and more expensive, assets have, because of this optical illusion. But wages haven't gone up, remember, right? That's the key thing. Assets are going like this. We were doing this before because of demographics, and it was making people pissed. And now we're doing it from debasement, and there's no way around it. So what debasement does, on the other hand, remember, it makes the price of assets look like it's going up. This is why you can't have a banking crisis of the order of magnitude that existed before 2008. The reason being is you just print money the moment you see it, and voila, everything goes up. So the value of your collateral, so if you think about a debt, it's collateral plus the debt, and the collateral is what guarantees the debt. If you've got a banking crisis, your collateral is often falling so fast that, like commercial real estate, right? We're going to have a problem with that. So there's a bunch of debt, and the banks have got this commercial real estate as collateral, and it's all bloody empty, and everybody's going to try and get out of it. So the answer to that is print money and essentially magic that collateral higher, or put it on the central bank balance sheet. Europe has already done this. So I don't think you can have a systemic collapse because the value of the assets can never go down enough. This is what most people can't get their heads around.
Well, so I'm going to...
But we will get... Slightly... You know, but there is... We'll play out the future a bit because there are ways where it could go even more wrong than this ongoing mutualization amongst the people of the cost.
It can go even more wrong.
Well, this is wrong because it's insidious. You don't see it. You don't notice it. You just sense it, right? That's what's going on. But it could lead to another outcome. The other outcome could be a total loss of control of the financial system. I don't think that is going to be the case. But okay, there's a possibility.
Yes. And so this is getting into, I have a growing thesis that is... It's beginning to touch everything. I need to find a word for this, but the level of awareness of a problem when it is ubiquitous, you would think that's good because it kills the arbitrage where only the people who are aware of it are able to take advantage of it. And that sounds bad and it sounds evil, but as everyone becomes aware of it, the only outcome that I see from that is cynicism. And I come at it from an entertainment perspective, which may seem very weird for people, but I grew up in the 80s, which I actually want to talk about the 80s and why the 80s felt so awesome living through it, because I think it actually planted a seed for something problematic. But anyway, so the 80s from a film perspective was awesome. You could have a movie where Arnold Schwarzenegger throws a knife and it goes through a guy and it pins him to the wood beam behind him and he says, stick around. And it isn't, you're actually laughing in the moment. You're not laughing at how... many times you've heard a line said like that, or, oh my God, that's like an Arnie line. It was the first time you'd ever heard or seen anything like that. And it was just legitimately funny. And over time though, we become aware of all these patterns to the point where if you grew up watching movies and you grew up in a world where 80s movies were a thing and they've been mimicked so many times and done to death, everything happens with a wink. And once everything happens with a wink, everybody lives in this ironic world where being more cynical than the next person, memeing something faster than the next person becomes the thing. And so one of the things, and I feel a moral obligation to get the information out about what the world of finance really is as fast as I can. And yet I know that as everybody becomes aware of the trick won't work anymore. So I'm in this weird spot of like wanting to tell people, hey, when they print money, quantitative easing, they are counterfeiting money. It is destroying your buying power. But it is the only way that we glide. So it's like,
But you're keeping the monkeys happy by lowering the cost of TV sets and other stuff, right? That's the other weird thing. Consumable goods are cheap.
Yes. Now we're really getting in because now that we have to talk about metaverse and how if you want to pacify people, that's a totally different thing.
No, but we have pacified them with cheap TVs, cheap beer, cheap food, cheap everything.
But they're still derailing, man. They are still derailing.
Because the asset, which is your future self, it's your future consumption, has gone up so much that nobody can afford them. So you've kept them happy with dopamine and sugar hits of crap.
You've kept them numb. I won't say you've kept them happy. You've kept them numb.
Okay. Yeah, happy is the wrong word, but you're right. But look, this is, I went down this journey that you're going down now in 2012. And that journey led me to crypto. I saw it and I knew that this was the answer. And that's why I first bought Bitcoin in 2013 was exactly this, is once you see what has happened, we know the system now, regardless of how it ends, whether it ends in slow ongoing death of economic vibrancy or a spectacular blow up? The answer is you need to transition to what I call the Bitcoin life raft or the parallel financial system. Mm. It's there and you can participate with $1 or $1 billion. It's an egalitarian system. Okay,
we're gonna get to crypto, but we have to get to your everything code. I think this is crazy important. So I went in and listened. I must have listened to it. Oh God, you're gonna think I'm kidding. 30 times to write it down verbatim. You delivered. I had never heard you do it so succinctly. And so I wrote it down verbatim. And what I want to do is I'm gonna go through your everything code, but we're gonna stop in a couple key areas to make sure that people really understand this. So I'm going to read a section and then give you a chance to, if you think there's something that you can say even more concisely or whatever, but you just delivered this so well. So here it goes. So Raoul has a theory that everything is related to one phenomena. And once you understand it, things get a lot easier to predict. So here we go. It's a quote from Raoul. What I had suddenly stumbled across in the Everything Code was the fact that the global central banks had probably agreed together sometime around 2012 after Europe blew up that with governments at 100% of GDP in debt, they were going to crowd out all of the private sector and we were going to just keep having financial crises. Okay, so you mentioned earlier this idea of 100% debt, 100% of GDP in debt, so I don't think we have to go over that again. But the part in this section that I don't understand is this concept of the government competing with private sector. So
this is the bit we talked about, right? So the economy grows at 2%. The government needs that to pay its interest because it's 2%.
How does it use that to pay its interest?
Well, basically it comes
because they're just taking more in taxes?
Exactly, right? There's a level of economic growth that needs to service the interest payments. But if everybody's interest payments are too high, The answer is firstly to have the interest rate as low as possible, mm-hmm. which is why the Japanese have a much lower natural rate of interest than everybody else because they're 260% of GDP in debt, but their companies are less in debt.
So they've trapped themselves. They have so much debt they can't let the interest rate rise.
Nobody can. This is why we're going to have a recession and we're going to cut rates back down to zero. It's impossible to work. So this is the thing is. Once all of these governments hit 100%, then they either blow up the private sector, the banking sector, corporates, or the government sector.
How,
you choose.
Because
there's not enough income to service that level of debt because GDP growth keeps declining.
Okay, so let me see if I understand this. So when you say private sector, you mean private banking?
No, I mean all private sector, households. So how does the average person service the interest? It's again from economic activity, the activity mm-hmm. that they have. So the same with corporations, and the banking system is involved intricately within that whole system. So economic activity is what pays the interest. If you don't have a job, you can't service your mortgage or your credit card, right? Fact. And if your debt growth keeps going up, you need to keep your wages going up to pay your debts. That's the GDP side of the equation. But what we're finding is that all debt that is in excess of GDP at government level is ending up on the balance sheet 3.5 years later.
Okay. How?
Quantitative easing. And I did the maths on this, and I think I was the first person to really figure, I don't think anybody's really figured this out yet. I went and looked at this, and I realized that what they were monetizing was the interest payments on the debt 3.5 years later. Okay. Why 3.5 years? In 2008, all interest rates went to zero. Every government refinanced itself at zero. And most of the debt for all governments is in the 3 to 5 year sector. So somewhere between 3 to 5 years, 3.5, 4 years. And what happens is every time you service the debt, you need to get the interest rates back down again. You end up having a recession. You get this very cyclical phenomena.
Because are they deferring the need to pay for 3 to 5 years?
Nobody pays back debt. Nobody. Nobody is paying back any debt anywhere. So what they're doing is every time it comes to pay to service the next amount of debt, it ends up on the Fed balance sheet. Now, it actually happens because there's an economic slowdown driven by the debt, but that's what happens. And there is a marginal difference in the size. This is true of the US, the UK, the EU, Japan. They're all the same. And the difference of the balance sheets is slightly bigger. And the difference is every time there's a direct financial crisis, they have to put direct money in. So we've already just seen a little bit of that in the US.
Okay, Europe, so the difference would be buying the federal bank, buying assets versus just stimmy checks? Is that what you mean by direct money?
So stimmy checks, that's coming in onto the bank balance sheet because that is government debt that will end up getting monetized 3.5 years later, which happens to be end of this year into next year. Which is why I think we've got a lot of quantitative easing coming, because we've got to monetize all of the bloody interest payments from the pandemic.
And when we say monetize, we mean print money.
Print money and put it on the Fed balance sheet, i.e. just print money. Expand the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve.
To match what is owed, we will create money.
Correct. And that's using a credit card to pay off your other credit card, essentially, right? Printing
now, is that
money,
what you mean by nobody is servicing debt? Is just everybody's correct. Printing more money?
Correct.
Because surely they are paying the debt
payments. No debt is getting paid off. You're just rolling the interest payment. So it keeps getting bigger every year.
Hold on. If we owe China money, there's no way China's just like, oh, word, it's all good, push it off. So surely we are, at a minimum, printing money in order to pay those government debts. Right?
But when that comes up after 4 years, you just issue new debt.
But you issue new debt to yourself so that you can then pay off whoever you owe money to, surely.
No, because the government is borrowing the money here, right? So what they just pay off, they don't pay off the debt. They just do it again. So it's like your mortgage comes up at the end, and imagine you just had interest payments. You just roll it again and say, oh, I'm just going to pay interest for another 30 years. Nobody ever pays off the actual loan. And nobody cares as long as you get the interest, which is weird. Now, if you pay off the loan, you optically do it, but you issue a new one again. So it's like, I'm going to pay off my credit card with my brand new credit card I've got. And so I've got rid of my Capital One credit card.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is when they're printing the money, they are paying off the debt. They're just creating new debt in the equal amount or more, but they are technically paying that debt off. Otherwise, I can't fathom how anybody would do it.
Debt, okay. So debt is growing in all of these countries at GDP plus the interest payments. And that interest payment component is going on the balance sheet. And that's happening everywhere, including Japan. So they're all doing exactly the same thing, which is interesting. Because that doesn't happen by accident. There is an understanding that the world is too much in debt and there's no way of dealing this without us all going back into caveman times. So this is the answer.
Yeah, I think this is where we have to look at Radio's thesis. And I think this is what has really painted my thinking. So Ray is just like, look backwards, last 500 years of history, every time you've gotten to this point where you're gliding, it always ends with either economic war or actual hot weaponry war. And you need this level of trauma so that people will finally go, fine, everything that I owed, I'm just going to let go of it. Whatever. It is what it is. I just want peace. And so you get this complete upending of everything. We reset, we go back to zero, but we do it in the most grueling, brutal, sacrificial way possible. And I hear this a lot from people like, this all rebalanced in 100 years. Sure, but that is cold comfort to millennials who could never buy a house, right? Like,
so yes, but this is where the fourth turning comes to me, right? I think we are at economic warfare. Everybody needs an enemy. So we've decided that China, Russian, whoever we want to be our enemy is our enemy. So we are economic warfare for the share of the pie. But the world is not, it's not actually a fixed pie. There's an abundance. And that abundance is the other economic warfare, which is technology. But that's happening at a massive scale. And it's going into space. It's going everywhere. So we've got physical kind of warfare, economic warfare over technology. which is what Taiwan is all about. You know, they own the secret code, which is the ability to produce computer chips in ways that nobody else can replicate. So there's that. And then we are at war with each other as the population is split and wants to blame each other for what has happened, when in fact it was actually the baby boomers that actually caused the problem in the first place. The people caused the problems of the people.
In fairness, so, it was the greatest generation that had all the sex that gave birth to the baby boomers that created the problem. And this is where it gets tricky, because God bless the greatest generation for fighting the wars, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, before we keep going down that road, because I want to keep this all in the construct of your everything code, because this was very enlightening. Okay, so you just walked us through that first part about why we're going to keep having these financial crises, and the only way out of that is to print money, basically. Okay, next section. And the only way, here we go. And the only way of solving this is putting it on the central bank balance sheet, because there's not enough GDP to pay the interest. This is what you were just talking about. So if you think about GDP growth, let's call it 2%, and let's assume that interest rates are 2%, which is roughly where they've been since 2008. So if the government is 100% GDP in debt and GDP grows at 2%, but interest payments are also at 2%, that's all of GDP growth just to pay the interest on the US government debt. But the private sector, excluding the financial sector, so households and corporations, are another 120% of GDP in debt. Well, that will give you negative growth every year of 2%, and it just compounds. So what happens is those interest payments go to the Fed balance sheet and they monetize it. Again, this is what we were just talking about. So then the private sector is not competing with the government, and that was provable across all major economies. It's like they all decided that they're too far in debt, and the only way to solve this is quantitative easing. And then I started thinking, well, if I know this to be true, and I know that the central bank balance sheets are 97% correlated with the asset prices, well, all I need to do is use forward-looking indicators to predict the central bank balance sheets and/or interest payments. Dude, talk to me about this 97% correlated with assets. That seems like having a crystal ball.
So it doesn't. It actually reflects today. So you could basically, as I explained before, the thing that's actually driving the S&P 500 is the Fed balance sheet. It's not companies getting more
valuable. When you say driving, you mean driving the price.
Correct. So it's an optical illusion. It's a money illusion.
So the price simply rises to meet the level of inflation caused by printing money.
Correct. You're readjusting the price. So that is what's going on. And so then when you understand that, and it's 97%, you understand that nothing matters apart from this liquidity, which is what I've been trying to tell people, is sorry, all your economic models are wrong. Yes, you need to forecast the business cycle to know where you are in the probability of printing money cycle, but that's all that matters, and it drives assets. And that's why people right now are getting very angry, because the stock market's going up and they're like, yeah, but don't you know there's a recession? Yeah, I know that the answer to recession is more cowbell, printing of more money, which is why I explain to people.
This is what I'm talking about with, as people become aware of these issues, as you zoom out and you see the gigantic crater, you begin to realize, oh, we're in a recession. That means they're going to print money. So in a recession, prices are going up, and people are like, yeah, I know where this goes. So that's crazy. And that it'll be very interesting to see what the knock-on effects are of the everybody becoming aware of these patterns. And I've heard you say that it's almost always the path of most pain is the path that ends up actually happening. And so as we begin to predict, oh, this is what's going to happen, the fact that we can predict will have some very sort of painful consequences.
The important point being here is, I know what drives liquidity. It's driven by the business cycle. And there are certain cycles that are forward-looking. The Chinese credit cycle happens to lead by about 18 months or 2 years.
For people that don't know what the business cycle is, can you give a primer?
The business cycle is the ebb and flow in economic activity that occurs, and that's a boom and bust, a recession, expansion.
Is it caused by interest rates?
we don't really know what causes the business cycle. It's caused partly by interest rates. It's caused by excess production, excess inventories, too limited inventories. There's many things that can drive a business cycle, but it's observable and has been observable for millennia. And one of the things we do is when the business cycle is too hot and inflation starts rising, central banks tend to raise interest rates. That tends to bring down economic activity. I think even without a central bank, interest rates would rise naturally, because I think the free market can set interest rates without a central bank. And then the economy slows down again, and we see this endless cycle. So what I think my hypothesis is that, okay, this is very observable. I think it's going to last, this relationship between assets and the central bank balance sheet, because of the mechanism of debasement of currency. And I can forecast out what the business cycle looks like. And I also know the amount of interest payments that need to be made, because they happened 3.5 years ago. And I can see how far the balance sheet's going to expand. So the balance sheet right now is, what, $6.5 trillion. And it looks like it will get $7 trillion or so. And it looks like it will get to $12 to $14 trillion by the end of 2025. So that puts, and there's a number of other ways I've proven this out in this whole thing. And I'll send you the whole piece myself. I've not really gone public with all of the whole thing of how it works. But in the end, that puts asset prices massively higher than here, hugely higher. So we're looking at more than a doubling of the NASDAQ from here. Ooh. We're looking at another gigantic crypto run. That's into 2025. So we're seeing huge moves that just come from the debasement. And I've gone through in the Everything Code article that I wrote for Global Macro Investor, which is my kind of premium research service. In that, I've gone through various ways of proving this all out. So that's what I think I can do. But your observation, I think, is really important. Okay, when people, I mean, I've sent this to quite a few people, and obviously the subscribers of Global Macro Investor are kind of the world's most famous hedge fund managers, asset managers. And I think it really shocked people and resonated with people. They're like, oh my God, everything makes sense now. And so once you see it, it all makes sense. Now, as it becomes more public as a thesis, and Mike Howell at Cross Border Capital has been talking some elements of this, liquidity, you can see liquidity becoming part of the conversation on financial Twitter and stuff now. What I think we'll probably do is create boom bust cycles. Again, you can't have the bust cycle going below the level of central bank liquidity, because optically they make it rise. This is what people don't yet understand. But of course, the stock market should go down 90%. Can't happen. Literally can't happen because of the debasement. It's a money illusion. But what I think we'll do is see, hey, off we go to the races. That's what happened in 2019, early 20, we actually diverged from the central bank balance sheet massively, because people starting to figure out this game, which is the moment the Fed stopped the tightening cycle, markets take off, because they know that the probability of more cowbell, more central bank printing of money, more interest rate cuts is coming. And so therefore we get boom bust cycles. So the boom times are too big, and then you get a bust. And people know that from crypto as well. The long-term trend remains intact, but we keep getting these huge booms, collapse, boom, collapse, but the trend is still up. I think that's what we'll see. We'll be more like the crypto cycle, which is pretty much what we've just seen as well. We had a big collapse last year, and now we're straight back into the boom as we're starting to forecast this.
All right. So let me see if I'm tracking all of this.
Sorry, there is a lot in this.
No, man, there is. But the more I go over this stuff, the more times I encounter it, the more I'm really beginning to piece together what's happening. It is, though, leading me to a level of distress. It does not make me calm. And it's leading me to a level of distress. While I agree with you, when you start looking beyond the next 20 years, it evens back out, and we hopefully get the exponential age, and that works out. But I think there's such a period of tumult that...
No. Yes. Okay. Let's get down to an individual level. Let's not get to societal level. I can unfuck your future, which is the series that we ran on Real Vision, by simply offering you the right asset. You get caught in this trap If you own crypto or technology, you will outperform this entire thing. Now, if you're not wealthy enough to buy, you know, set up a brokerage account doing that because it's complicated for you, you can do it with crypto for no money. And you'll participate not only in the trend of debasement, so you're not getting left behind. Because if you're just getting an income and you're not buying any assets, you're truly getting behind. So your 401k may look like the S&P 500. That's not making you any richer. Just buy technology or buy crypto. And those are the only two assets that outperform the central bank balance sheet. So there's your solve at a personal level.
All right. Before we can get into that, I think we have to track. We have to track why. Let's recap why you get this, the stock market rising and falling with the printing of money. So you've covered that very well, but just by quick recap, as you pump money into the system, then the cost of the assets are necessarily going to rise because they are a scarce asset. And as there's more money available, those prices are going to rise. They're going to rise in proportion. And so you can just watch them rise and lower together. Now, the reason why, and I'll say Bitcoin maybe instead of crypto, just because there's a lot of things going on in crypto that get a little dodgy. And so I'll focus, I don't think Bitcoin, I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist by any stretch of the imagination, but
no, but Bitcoin's a clear way of describing this.
Correct. So when you look at Bitcoin, the reason, and you were the first person to show me a chart that basically shows the price of Bitcoin goes up as money is pumped into the system. And it's interesting that it tracks in the same way that the stock market tracks, but for the exact opposite reason. So the reason that the price of Bitcoin is going to go up is people are like, yo, I need to be somewhere where I can't have my value debased through the creation of additional, right? So printing of money. So when you print money, buying power goes down because prices rise in commensurate with the amount of money going into the system. So you feel like you're getting richer, but you're not. It's an illusion. God, I love that you use that word. Okay. So people then pour into Bitcoin because they're like, there will only ever be 22 million. That's just it. And so since I know that that's it, that it is a finite cap, it will never go more, then you can't debase it through the printing of additional Bitcoin. Okay. So people flood into that and you see it rise. And so that was the first time, because I was like, people were speculating, what is Bitcoin? What does its price respond to? And once you pointed out it responds to the M2 global money supply, I was like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. So walk people through then how to play that game well. Why technology? That we haven't addressed yet. So why technology? And how do you do Bitcoin well? Is it a buy and hold? Are you trading? What does that look like?
So if with Bitcoin, I treat it as an asset that is going to protect my long-term wealth. And that sounds crazy when it goes up and down like it does. Right. And you've just gone through that full first cycle and you're like, oh. But what you'll find is the low is higher than the last time it hit the bottom. And then the next low will be higher and each high is higher. Oh, it's in an uptrend. So I just don't need to sweat about the ups and downs. What I should do is just accumulate every time it's at a down cycle. Why? Well, because the down cycle is signifying that economic contraction is happening and that the world is slowing down and money's being taken out of the system, quantitative tightening, which is the opposite process, and assets fall and interest rates are going up. So your disposable income's going down because your wages aren't going up enough and interest rates have gone up more. So it's at that point, you know, the outcome is if economic activity is going to slow down the next year in a year's time, they're going to be printing money or cutting rates because it's very cyclical for the phenomena of this rolling of this debt. So therefore you should be buying more at these points because then you've got the next upside cycle to come, which is what I've always said is, it's the cyclical trend within a secular trend.
Okay, this is guaranteed people do not know the difference.
So secular trend is something long-term trend driven by a large explainable factor. Bitcoin is an answer to the financial system, and over time, the number of users and people who become aware of its superpower, the more people move across. That is a secular trend of adoption. That's really important. The cyclical trend, the cyclicality, is the ebb and flow. within it. So that's the boom bust of the economy. Not at a gigantic bust level, it's just a boom bust. Now, Bitcoin halving cycles correspond with all of this. Why? Is there some magic in that reduction of supply? Maybe. But Bitcoin came out exactly at the same time that all interest rates went to zero. They're all part of the same cycle. So every time we get into this economic cycle, it affects Bitcoin in the same way. But over the long run, the adoption, the secular cycle, means it outperforms everything. Because there's no secular adoption of the S&P 500. There's no secular adoption of General Electric. That stuff's not really happening. Yes, there's an ongoing purchasing by 401ks, but that's really it. So that big mega trend is the observable trend that people can participate in, and it is going to more than offset what is going on with the debasement of currency. And that's to do with Metcalfe's law and the exponential trend of the adoption of a technological network or a technology itself. Great. So that's why Bitcoin charts over time just keep doing this. It's because it's exponential. The S&P 500 doesn't do that because it's not exponential. But the NASDAQ does. Most technologies do. And the reason why the NASDAQ keeps outperforming the S&P and keeps outperforming value stocks and makes people so angry is because it's all about the adoption of new technology. If you think about what's been driving the NASDAQ recently, it's the adoption of AI. Obviously, that's the fastest adoption of any technology in history. Crypto was the fastest beforehand, but this has eclipsed it. It's gone from, in 6 months, from basically zero users to 100 million users in 6 months. We've never seen like it.
I want to put an interpretation of what you just said forward and tell me if this is accurate, because I thought your punchline was going to be the reason that technology outperforms the illusion of prices going up is because it's an increase in productivity per capita. But what I hear you saying with Metcalfe's law is it's actually outperforming because of what I will call, you're going to hate this word, but hype. That basically the people are pouring into it. They're so excited. About, no, oh my God.
That's not what Metcalfe's law is.
I know what Metcalfe's law is, but I'm saying if you really think about why Metcalfe's law would drive value that exceeds the illusion, that is the only thing I can take away from that. Because if it isn't increasing productivity per capita, why would it otherwise outstrip?
No, it is, and we'll come onto that in a sec. But Metcalfe's law is the number of nodes on a network, i.e. number of users of crypto,
yep,
versus the number of applications and the interconnection. So the more we build out a Web3 world, the more that's the multiplier as opposed to the people. Initially, it's the people who use it. So like Doge has no use case apart from memes, memetics, but it has a bunch of users. Bitcoin has limited use, but a huge amount of users as well. But the use case is very clear, which is the scarcity of the asset and the purity of the asset and the security of the network. Ethereum has lots of uses, DeFi, NFTs, all of this stuff, and a whole load of users. So this is what's driving these things. Why are we adopting the technology? That's the productivity equation. The financial system becomes more productive and safer and securer by using cryptocurrency rails. We become superpowers as humans by adopting AI, robotics. We become more productive and ability to do stuff by adopting EV technology. All of this stuff is actually driving productivity. Now, here's another.
So I need to push back on that. So I don't think the value created in Web3, speaking as somebody is as in Web3 as a human can be. I've put just a gazillion of my own dollars into this. It's right now, it is all people betting that this is going to be the future versus it actually being the future right now. So that's why
that's how you make money, my friend. The moment is the moment the investment. There are use cases. So let's just get out of the NFT noise and everything else. I'm having dinner with a friend of mine. He used to run the trading operations of one of the largest banks in Australia. And it's a big bank. the equivalent of Bank of America. And he's like, yeah, you know, he's just retired. And he's like, yeah, I've been heavily involved in crypto at the bank doing stuff. I'm like, what are you guys doing? He goes, we've issued 5 stable coins. I'm like, why? Why do you need the stable coins? Why, you know, why not use Tether or USDC or whatever? He's like, okay, so this is what people don't understand, why crypto is so important for the financial system. He said, we're in Australia. We have a gigantic pension system. Our pension system buys a gigantic amount of US equities. The US is about to go to settlement. So when you buy a share and you have to pay for it from T+2 or T+3, so that's trade date plus 3 days to pay for the bill, T+1. Okay, that seems fine. Foreign exchange transactions are T+2. They can't settle the US stocks that they buy. So they either have to leave massive amounts of money with a broker that they dealt with who could go bust or uses the money ineffectively, or they create a stable coin for instance. And they built that. This one is on top of Ethereum. Okay, fine. But that is a multi-hundred-billion-dollar use case for why crypto is very powerful for increasing productivity within the financial system alone. And there's many of these all over the place. So why is Tether such a big, useful stablecoin? You've basically fractionalized the US dollar and now a person in the Philippines who works in a rice field to receive a payment from his cousin who's living in New York City instantaneously without any cost in dollars, which is the currency that they all want. That's mind-blowing. That's why the stablecoin system alone is so gigantic. So I don't agree with there is no productivity or killer app. The killer app of crypto so far has actually been stablecoins. And that
I want to make sure what I'm saying is very nuanced, but I don't think I'm being clear enough yet. So what I'm saying is that Metcalfe's law, if the reason that tech has outperformed is because of Metcalfe's law, which remember, I was surprised to hear you say that. I didn't think that's what you were going to say. I thought you were going to say productivity, but you said Metcalfe's law. If that's true, and I'm just trying to understand what the reality is, and you're saying this is how you make money, I'm with you. I'm just trying to understand what this is in without fancy concepts, just like the down-home nitty-gritty. So Metcalfe's law is, as far as I can tell, that is the point at which it is hype. It's people getting excited. Now, they may be hype for good reasons. No. They may be hype because they're right about where productivity is coming from. But then let me ask it this way. For those just listening, he's shaking his head. Is there a difference between Metcalfe's law and productivity? Or to you, are they one and the same?
No, they're two entirely different concepts. Metcalfe's law is the value of a network and how to value it. And
those are two very different statements. Is it the value of the network or is it how you value its future utility?
Every vote that goes into a market, i.e. every time price moves, is a vote about current expectations and future expectations. So it's difficult to parse out what that means. But I've provably shown that I can distill Metcalfe's law pretty simply in cryptocurrency to two things. Number of active users. Okay, that makes sense. That's the nodes. Mm-hmm. And then the value of the economic activity. And all I did was the dollar value that gets exchanged every month or week. Those two numbers multiplied out gives this crazy, ridiculously large number. But that, when you put it on a graph, is exactly the same as price. And so it's remarkable because price is not in that equation. So
does Metcalfe's law take in the math that you were just saying, the value of the transactions on the network?
No, Metcalfe's law. Nobody knows how to fully measure a Metcalfe's law value system, so you need to approximate it because it's quite a complex mathematical formula and you're dealing with imperfect worlds where you can't put it in. But anyway, that's nothing to do with the productivity. People are flocking to the technology because it increases, whether it's your productivity or solves other solutions for you.
I'm going to say that slightly differently, and this is where I'm surprised. It's very possible I'm missing something. You are so much more thoughtful on this stuff than I am currently, but this still, what I'm about to say still seems true to me. And that is that Metcalfe's law is the is the observable response to when people believe something is going to be amazing. So take ETH. People believe that building on Ethereum is going to be the future. I'm one of them. I believe it to the core of my existence, but it hasn't yielded that yet.
No, that's not right. Every mobile phone network is priced at Metcalfe's law. All networks are priced at Metcalfe's law. But
why can't they be?
I don't think it matters, Tom. I think you're getting caught in a thing that doesn't really matter. What matters to the bigger equation? The two things that matter with this whole thing is, does Bitcoin protect you from this issue of debasement, the mutualization of losses amongst everybody? Yes. Okay, fine. Nothing else matters there. Does it? Could it be form part of what I call the exponential age of technologies, which could eventually increase productivity? Yes. Now, they're not mutually exclusive. There's no, Metcalfe's law is just a measurement of the value of a network. But this productivity idea is the big one. And the productivity idea is, if we can't change, we can't keep increasing the debt. Remember, the magic formula was population growth or productivity growth plus debt growth. We can't change the population. The debt growth's got too far. So we've got this one thing in the middle. It's the only thing that can change this entire equation. So what we can do is try and grow that. Okay, now let's step back and say, okay, what's happening to the world that's a really big change that happened that the central banks are looking like they're going to print money to do? And that's the Green Revolution. It's being driven by Europe, but it's being driven elsewhere. So yes, climate change, yes, all of the benefits of doing this, but there is a magic outcome. So productivity, let's say, we use AI, we can do more stuff. And you and I have talked about this in the past, right? We can expand now human knowledge in ways we couldn't do before. And factory lines and agricultural machinery just basically created more productivity per human. Okay, fine. But the big equation in this is the inflation-adjusted price of oil, which let's call that the kind of best benchmark for energy input costs, have been $40. In inflation-adjusted terms, for 70 years, 60 years. So we've got a fixed thing here, which is, can we put more output per calorie or kilojoule of energy? That is what productivity is all about. So technology keeps rising, and that's great, keeps going. But all of these governments are focused on the other part of this equation, which is, can I lower the cost of energy? Because if you drop the cost of energy from $40 per barrel of oil equivalent to 10, you 4x productivity. And there is your solution. And that is why they're pouring trillions of dollars into this. And we're seeing what's known as Wright's law, sorry, all these terms, which is the increase in output of a new technology has a commensurate measurable decrease in the cost. And we're seeing that with all of the green energy. So it's just getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. Now, we can't scale it enough yet, but we know that there's nuclear, there's going to be part of this equation. There's a bunch of things. But over time, we will move away from that $40 fossil fuel anchor and move to $10. So think of the multiplier, because technology is doing this and the cost is doing that. That is what the productivity miracle that is coming.